All right, what up? Welcome back to another edition of the podcast that's still not been named. This is Ben from Blazers Edge. I'm here with my one and only Seattle Storm fan, Kevin Pelton. Kevin, what's up?
What's up, Ben? It's going to be kind of a lonely Blazers Edge night at Kyrian, it turns out, this Saturday.
Yeah, well, I heard we sold out the entire arena, right? It was something like 15,000 people had purchased tickets.
That many people were that excited to meet up with KP, too.
I know, it's crazy. Well, whatever. What can we expect? Oh, yeah, so let's get the plug out of the way. Saturday night, Storm versus Liberty, 7 p.m. You could probably just bring a can of food and get into the arena at this point. I'm not even sure if they're going to make you buy a ticket. No, kidding. Just kidding. Sorry, Seattle Storm people. But, yeah, we'll be there. Hang out with us afterwards. This is getting a little desperate, so we'll stop talking about it. So, on to our podcast topics for today that do not involve women's basketball, and that would be Brandon Roy, who is probably the greatest thing to ever come out of your hometown of Seattle. Would you agree?
You know, I think that's a fair assessment.
Do you have more personal pride in Brandon Roy's success than your own success? Because let's be real, you've been in like the Wall Street Journal, ESPN.com, probably most importantly, you've been featured on BlazersEdge.com. I had to go with increasing importance. You know, I started with the Wall, you know, you saw what I did there. But anyway, so you have that, like your own personal pride in your writing, which you obviously take very seriously. But then you've got this, like, absolutely perfect human being who plays perfect basketball the right way from your hometown. He just gives every interview you could possibly want. He's friendly. You know, he'd probably go to, like, Dave and Buster's and hang out with you. He very well might hang out with us after the Seattle Storm game. I completely made that up. But it's the kind of person he would do that. And he gives back to his community. So who do you have more pride in as a Seattleite, yourself or Brandon Roy?
Well, he's a Seattleite. Brandon Roy, no doubt about it. I mean, coming from the University of Washington, my alma mater, and kind of leading the hoops renaissance for the Huskies. I don't want to upset the Duck fans on the call too much by going on and on about Lorenzo Romar and company. But you know, it's really remarkable. We had the Scholes wrote about this, the Adonai Hood Classic last Sunday that was played at, I think, at Garfield, maybe one of the other high schools. And I guess it was Garfield Community Center, something like that. And you had for Franklin, Aaron Brooks. You had for Rainier Beach, Nate Robinson, Jamal Crawford. I think Terrence Williams. Terrence Williams was on the roster at that time. I'm not sure if he ended up playing because I didn't go myself. Then Roy was on the roster for Garfield. He didn't play because he wanted to get the whole contract extension wrapped up. But it's really kind of crazy the amount of hoops talent that has come out of the city of Seattle.
See, is it the same way in Washington where I think in Oregon, Brandon Roy is probably the most recognizable and the most popular person in the entire state. Is it the same way in Seattle, or is there anyone else that's up there? Maybe Bill Gates, I guess. Or would there be anyone else?
That's interesting. I mean, in the sports world, I don't know if the Seahawks would have anybody at this point. Matt Hasselbeck would probably be the closest comparison. You had Ichiro with the Mariners, who's immensely popular, but kind of, you know, be more distant and reserved, just his personality and his being a foreigner. That's interesting. I'd have to think about that. I mean, the fact that Roy doesn't play in Seattle makes it hard, but he's definitely up there.
Yeah, see, that's the thing about this whole, like, contract negotiation that finally wrapped up. Well, I guess they're going to have the press conference tomorrow now. But it's basically in the stage of being wrapped up. He's supposedly signing the contract today. He got his max money. And, you know, when there was sort of this idea that maybe he wouldn't get exactly what he wanted, a lot of people in Portland panicked and seemed to, like, take it really personally. It was almost like they personally were not getting the contract that they wanted at work. You know what I mean? It's like people
feel like
because
Cardano took that a little literally.
Oh, yeah, well,
it's his call.
Yeah, well, all right, 2 minutes in and we're already going to bash John Canzano again. I can see where this podcast is going.
next week we're taking down Joe Freeman.
No, I like Freeman. See, Freeman's
I like Freeman as well, I want to be clear. It was just like the next on the line at the Oregonian.
Oh, I see. Well, pretty soon we're going to be all the way up to sports editor Mark Hester, and we could talk about how Actually, we're probably going to have to edit this part out, so I won't even go down that route. But no, but in seriousness, people took it really personally because they have an investment in Brandon Roy. I don't think you see in the normal NBA player. I mean, are you invested in LeBron James? I mean, I'm not invested in LeBron James in any way. I wouldn't buy a T-shirt with him on it. Not that I would buy a T-shirt necessarily with Brandon Roy on it. That'd be kind of weird. But I'm just not personally invested in LeBron James or even really Dwight Howard or any of the marquee names out there. And yeah, I think Brandon Roy's got a sway over thousands of people that the average NBA athlete or even the average NBA star doesn't have.
Well, I think we are going to see that. Something similar with LeBron James next year when he becomes a free agent and kind of the whole city of Cleveland holds its collective breath, hoping that he's going to re-sign there and not leave for New York or some other bigger market. So, you know, I think it is regional in that aspect of it. But I think that it shows that Brandon Roy is more than just a great basketball player to the city of Portland and to Blazers fans. You know, he represents, he's kind of the centerpiece and at the forefront of this whole rebuilding process, and not only rebuilding in terms of a basketball team, but in terms of a culture and identity that was so tarnished, you know, 5 years ago before he came on the scene, that to not reward Brandon Roy right away was in a lot of people's minds, I think, just unthinkable.
But that was overdone, wouldn't you agree? I mean, negotiations, $80 million contracts, you know, the idea with the new collective bargaining agreement, do you want someone on your books for 4 years instead of five? The idea that maybe Brandon would prefer four instead of five. I mean, don't those issues take some time to play out? Or do
Yeah,
you
I mean,
think it should have been done overnight?
it was the middle of July. I mean, there's no hurry. You've still got 2.5 months, nearly 3 months, to complete these contract negotiations within the extensions of the rookie contract, which will come into play with LaMarcus Aldridge. So I don't think it was something people. Yeah, I mean, you know, it appealed to kind of the sense of, oh no, everything's going wrong that was prevalent at that point with Hedo Turkoglu signing in Toronto and Paul Millsap getting his offer matched. I think it was understandable why it happened, but yeah, I mean, it was an overreaction.
See, one thing I think that people missed is that, you know, the main point in the original report that came out that Quick wrote, you know, sort of like the sky is falling kind of report, was that Bargnani had signed on day one. Why hasn't Brandon Roy signed? Because, you know, they're the same draft class and yada, yada, yada. But I mean, Bargnani was 5 years and 50, right? I mean, is there a big difference between 5 years and 50 and then 5 years and whatever, 82 or 87 or whatever it's going to end up being for Brandon? I mean, that's a significant difference. Don't you think, like, maybe Toronto feels like they got a pretty good value at $50 million, and that's why they did it day one before he could change his mind, as opposed to the Blazers were thinking like, well, we have to commit absolute max money to him. Let's maybe take this slowly and think it through. Do you think that those are
Yeah.
probably different situations?
I kind of think Bargnani got a great deal of 5 years and $50 million. I think he was the one who would want to be signing on the dotted line before they thought better of that, because it's a lot of money for a guy who has still not proven that he can do anything in this league besides hit threes.
Well,
But
let's be real. I think he's soft and a terrible player. I'm just saying that, you know, they were going to have to pay him at some point, and they probably felt like, you know, eventually the market value at $50 million would probably be about right, don't you think? I mean,
yeah,
he put
I mean
some
that's
numbers
why you signed a
around
deal.
that.
I think it's weird because Toronto was the only team that had extended anyone. I mean, you know, Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge. I think you could make an argument that they're the two top guys out there for extensions this summer. Rajon Rondo obviously belongs in that discussion, although there's a lot of extenuating circumstances in Boston if they're supposedly so fed up with him, and Doc Rivers feels he can't coach him, so that's kind of a weird situation. But you know, the guys who sign on the first day of the extensions, it's a pretty rare thing to expect that. And I mean, there's a reason that Bargnani was the only guy out of this group, even granting that it was a really weak draft class outside of the Blazers' pair of picks.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, I think that was just sort of a false comparison that was made like a month ago. Sort of in hindsight, now that we look at it, we see, okay, you know, those weren't necessarily the same situations. I think Brandon's going to come out of this being completely happy winning you. I don't think there's any bad blood that will spill over, do you?
No, I don't think it'll last, you know, whatsoever. I mean, and he got what he wanted, you know, 4 years plus that. He's got the option now for that fifth year, so he can kind of see where the market goes. And I think, you know, that's a comparison to what we saw with LeBron James and Dwayne Wade expected the market to potentially go up so much that they could opt out after 3 years of their extensions, which will be next summer in their case. And the hope being that they would be eligible then for a much more lucrative deal. Nowadays, we're looking at it a little more pessimistically, and I don't think Roy saw that possibility, but he's still got the out after 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's probably sitting back with just probably in a bathtub full of $100 bills, loving life right now, as he should. I mean, he's earned it. Like I said, the guys are just an absolute G. He's
dope man, dope man. I try to tell him I'm with Hope Floats, man. Ghetto spokesman. But both men approaching the bench with intent to bury me under the cell. Finger me as a toast man. Evidence stemming from 96. They say the world ain't recovered from its fix. While they was using cut, I was on some other shit. Gave it to you raw and they just discovered it. Now they, the jury got their brow raised, listening to testimony about my foul ways. Exhibit A, reasonable doubt. They say this was the first thing that turned the peoples out.
You know, back in the spring, I think maybe it was either your first or second piece that you did for Blazers Edge. You looked at similarities for all the different Blazers players. And, you know, it lost in the whole John Stockton and Sergio Rodriguez cloud, which was pretty fun for 48 hours, was the idea that, you know, Brandon Roy's similarities, even at this point in his career, given that, you know, he is a two-time All-Star, but he did go to school for 4 years, so he's older than the average player kind of coming in the NBA, has some pretty interesting names on there. So some of the standout names, obviously Kobe Bryant and Clyde Drexler, both of those are going to get people really excited. But then you also had names on there like Jason Richardson, Steve Francis, you know, a player who kind of started off really strong and then faded in Tracy McGrady. Where's Brandon Roy's career headed? I mean, obviously we can't guess what's going to happen with injuries, but, you know, what do you think his ceiling is?
You know, I think the fact that you have guys like Kobe Bryant on that list, and, you know, I've actually been rerunning the similarities right now for the 2009-10 season, and now they take into account 3 years of data instead of just the 1 year that we were previously looking at, so it's a bit of an upgrade, and it's still a fairly similar list. The one bizarre one that shows up is the other Eddie Johnson, the one who got in some legal trouble, to put it politely, a couple of years ago. And apparently, turns out, had a great first couple of seasons in the league for Atlanta, and then kind of faded after that. I don't think that's telling us much. But then Richardson and Finley stay right up there, along with Kobe Bryant, which is weird because I don't think people think of Brandon Roy as being kind of a Kobe Bryant type of player. But from a statistical profile, in terms of their ability to shoot it, get in the lane, create for teammates, it ends up being a pretty good match. You know, I think the question is, where does Brandon Roy develop the next couple of years? You know, we've seen him add to his game each year he's been in the NBA so far. I mean, what do you think is the most important thing for him to kind of develop?
Well, this is just brilliant. I mean, you must be just hacking into the Blazers Edge admin and reading the post that I have going for tomorrow, which is the five things that I want to see Brandon Roy develop. But I think the number one thing that people have talked about to this point for Brandon is the idea that, you know, Andre Miller is going to get him easier shots, or how are those two guys going to play together. And Brandon's already so efficient offensively, you kind of look at that and think, well, you know, he's already so good, does it really matter? But, you know, I was looking through some of the Synergy Sports statistics, and, you know, Brandon is, like, ridiculously accurate when he's not being guarded, when he's shooting uncontested jumpers. Then when he does have a hand in his face, his shooting percentage just drops drastically, like more than 10%. So I think, you know, a part of that is, you know, he's forcing up contested shots at the end of the shot clock, you know, bailing his teammates out when the offensive sets don't work. Or part of that's probably coming from the fact that, you know, Blake isn't necessarily the best at breaking people off the dribble and drawing attention. So Brandon's shooting a lot, you know, with his hands in his face. I think hopefully Miller will be able to help with that. So that would be one thing I'd like to see improve, is just, you know, his shot selection, not forcing shots, not finding themselves, you know, finding the offense more efficient in the idea that they're not playing up against the shot clock as much. But, you know, more than anything, what I want to see from Brandon next year is not necessarily any aspect of his game on the court, but it's more the leadership off the court and sort of the personal mentorship and really him embracing the idea that because he has this $80 million contract, because it's already been his locker room for the last two seasons, because he is an all-star, he's the kind of guy who doesn't need to sit back and be the quiet leader anymore. He's the kind of guy who can pull Greg Oden into the future. He's the kind of person who can say, hey, Greg, you know, waiting and seeing for you to get acclimated isn't going to cut it anymore. We're trying to win a championship. It's time for you to really blossom and develop and get comfortable in the locker room. And I like to see Brandon really be more hands-on in doing that because last season, you know, Brandon and Greg, they're kind of on opposite sides of the locker room, didn't interact very much. Mostly that's because kind of Greg was off in his own little world. But I really like to see Brandon, you know, put an arm over his shoulder, not that he could reach up that high, which would kind of look awkward if he did that, you know, but figuratively put his arm over Greg's shoulder and say, okay, I'm going to make sure that you can do this and make sure you're going to be in situations where you can succeed. I'm going to actually pass you the ball off the pick and roll. I'm going to be patient in letting your offensive game develop. I'm going to come over and be the first person congratulating you when you block a shot and really take ownership of that idea because right now, I mean, Brandon Roy can be an all-star for the next 10 seasons. This team's not going to win a title unless Greg Oden steps up.
Well, I think it's an interesting take. Leadership, to me, is kind of a combination of two things. You've got both the innate ability and maybe not ability so much as interest, where you have some guys who just are not going to ever be comfortable in that vocal role and are always going to be better as quiet leaders. And then you've also got experience, you know, naturally. I don't think it's any secret that veteran players are much better leaders than young players. So I think we're seeing Brandon get that kind of leadership experience. You know, he's been thrust into that role at a younger age than most people because of the fact that the Blazers have been such a young roster, and he's been, you know, the best player on the team and a guy who his teammates have looked up to pretty much since day one. In terms of having that demeanor, I feel like he has it to some extent, but not entirely, and we see it manifest itself in some ways, like the articles that we see from Jason Quick discussing his relationship with LaMarcus Aldridge and making sure that the two of those guys were close since they were two of the team's best players. With Greg, do you feel like there was an extent to which the other guys on the team, and Brandon in particular, felt like they just kind of had to let him work through some of those problems on his own during his rookie season?
I totally agree. Yeah, and I think it's incumbent upon Brandon to change that narrative. You know, Greg's had the time to work through it. Greg's been through it now for two full seasons. You know, Greg kind of needs to put up or shut up. That's kind of the feeling around the team from almost all observers, and maybe not necessarily from the front office, but I do think they put some pressure on Greg this summer to make sure he was ready for next season. And I think Brandon is in probably a stronger position than anyone else, even a stronger position than Nate, of helping Greg be able to succeed. Because one, he can involve him off the court doing the kind of dinner type things you're talking about with LaMarcus Aldridge, but he can also involve him on the court. You know, he can feed him the ball and he can be a supportive player. He can help correct on the floor in ways that nobody else on that team can. I mean, look, if I was Greg Oden, I wouldn't listen to anything that Steve Blake had to say. I mean, personally, there's just no connection there, you know? Greg Oden's the number one pick. Greg Oden has all this raw talent. Greg, you know, has had to work, but not in the same way that Steve had to work for his money. And I think that Brandon and Greg share a lot in terms of, you know, high expectations, drafted highly, under the microscope. And I think Brandon has a lot he could pass on to Greg. I mean, he handles everything so perfectly. It's like, on one side you have Brandon perfectly handling the media, perfectly, you know, being the face of a franchise. On the other you have Greg, totally uncomfortable fish out of water. I mean, don't you think there's some mentorship overlap that we could hope for? Or maybe could even expect from Brandon?
And I mean, you know, that's where we see the experience. I mean, Brandon had to go through some of that himself, you know, not in exactly the same ways, but when he was in high school, you know, he had to struggle to get into the University of Washington because he hadn't quite taken care of his academic business, and we saw him, you know, try to enter the draft directly out of high school, which in hindsight would have been a really bad decision for him. He might have been taken in the second round, maybe, more likely possibly would have gone undrafted, had to try to make it through the minor leagues or through overseas or something like that. So, you know, I think that experience really helped him grow up quite a bit by the time he got to UW and started playing for the Huskies. And I'm not sure, you know, that's one example of where I think him going through it himself helped. But I think, you know, then you want to, you know, I think Brandon may have wanted to see Greg come over and take that first step. You know, I mean, we're, you know, speculating at some point on stuff that we really don't know completely inside the locker room. But, you know, I think he may have been more comfortable with that. So maybe it's him changing his approach, like you said, and being that guy to make the first move, so to speak. Now, the one thing I want to know is, how do you think Andre Miller fits into this in terms of, he's potentially your starting point guard, and there's a natural leadership responsibility with that position. He's a veteran in the league. You know, I don't know exactly what kind of leadership position he took on in Philadelphia with younger guys, but he's someone who's going to fit into that leadership matrix, so to speak, as well, don't you think?
You know, I do, and I think that's a really interesting question, because I've heard kind of off-the-board chatter on both sides of that question. I've heard some people say, hey, he's a really great mentor for the young players. He really helped guys develop. I've heard other people say, hey, he just keeps to himself. He doesn't really interact with his teammates that much. He's kind of just about his business, and he kind of goes through. He hasn't played on a ton of really winning teams. He hasn't, you know, some of the teams kind of had questionable characters on there too, and that's not really an issue here in Portland. So you wonder if, I mean, he's, you know, by all accounts, he's kind of a serious guy. You wonder if some of his teammates turned him off from being a vocal leader just because they didn't take it as seriously as he did. Again, we're kind of speculating. I think the most interesting thing that came out of Andre Miller's press conference was sort of a side comment he made to someone who asked, you know, why didn't you take jersey number 7, or why did you, you know, not request it? And it was kind of a, you know, joking question, because obviously Brandon wears number 7. And Miller said, you know, kind of without hesitation, you know, that's the man's number. And, you know, he had never even considered asking for it. So you have that idea that I think he's already seeing himself as subservient to Brandon. This is sort of Brandon's team. So you wonder if, even though he plays that point guard leadership position, if he's already thinking in his head, I'm going to wait, I'm going to kind of postpone my own influence on these other guys to kind of let Brandon be the alpha male. Because I think on most NBA teams, you almost always have one alpha male. I think at least in the modern, the last couple of years, it's kind of clearly established who's the leader. You got LeBron, right? He's got all these guys, you know, taking pictures of the team before the game. It's all this ridiculous stunt that obviously he's come up with. You've got Kobe. All of his teammates are just terrified of him. I mean, I think Sasha Vujacic is dead, isn't he? I mean, I think his career is over because he was so afraid of Kobe Bryant, he passed out and died on the bench. You got guys, you know, Paul Gasol, just, you know, whatever Kobe does, you know, he'll fall right in line. And I think that's what people expect from Brandon, even a guy like Andre Miller who's been around. Even he expects that from Brandon. And I would be surprised to see Andre Miller exerting his personality early on next season. I guess that's the conclusion I would come to.
Well, I think if you look at those guys you mentioned, LeBron and Kobe, you just see to some extent the team taking on their personality. And with Brandon, I think what that is in terms of, you know, we're going to have fun when it's appropriate, but we're also going to work really hard and be serious when it comes to be game time. So I think that kind of matches what the Blazers have tried to do as an entire organization and starting with the front office. So I think that's, you know, a pretty good fit in terms of Brandon's leadership, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, and the one underrated aspect of Brandon is he's really kind of like a silent assassin. I mean, he can rip your heart out at the end of games. He's completely cold-blooded. I mean, he does not feel pressure at all. And, I mean, it's not even like he enjoys pressure situations. It's like pressure doesn't exist in his mind. I mean, talk about a great leadership quality and something that I would love to see passed on to Greg. I mean, I think Greg feels pressure when he orders food at, you know, Subway or Chipotle and he has to make decisions. You know, it's like black beans or pinto. I think Greg, like, freaks out at that decision, you know. And I think Brandon walks into Chipotle knowing exactly what food he wants to order. And he orders it perfectly, and he pays his exact change. You know what I mean? And I think...
So that's all for you. I'm wiping out your whole team. Ow, splatter your dreams with lyrics to shatter your schemes. The badder you seem, the more lies you tell. The more lies you sound, now by surprise you fell into my death trap, right into my clutches. Stupid, you know the guard must bless every single mic he touches. I've suffered just so I could return harder. Wanna be the shit starter, fuck around, make you a martyr. I'll make you famous, turn around and make you nameless, cause you never understood how vital to me this rap game is. Save it and hold that, you catch a hot one. Rhymes to chase a fake nigga down, soon
soon as I spot one.
Clip. If you wanna mess with this, gangstar.
All right, that's enough Brandon Roy talk. That was probably like three times more than we thought we were, but we concluded that he's the greatest person to ever live in the Pacific Northwest. He's a future Hall of Famer. He's going to be the savior of Greg Oden's career and much more. That was fun. Glad we did that. So the
children everywhere in the city of Portland will be born named Brandon for the next 20 years.
That would be awesome, actually, if we just changed both our names to Brandon. This podcast could be called the Brandon. If we did that, this podcast could be called the Brandon and Brandon podcast. We should consider doing that. That's actually a pretty catchy name. Anyway, the NBA news of this week is Rashard Lewis going Barry Bonds and getting busted for performance-enhancing drugs. And honestly, I think some people were a little bit surprised by this because, correct me if I'm wrong, the only person of note to have been busted for performance-enhancing drugs before was Darius Miles, Portland's favorite. And that was a weight loss drug of some sort, you know, some amphetamine that he was using to speed his system up and get the weight off after he was coming back from his rehab knee fiasco, which took like 4 years and still was on the Blazer books. That's another story. Anyway, Rashard Lewis is not coming from any kind of a situation like that. He's coming off an Eastern Conference Finals victory, NBA Finals appearance, probably his career year, national prominence for really the first time, and then this kind of comes out of the blue. What happened here? I mean, first of all, I guess, tell us what happened, and second of all, I mean, you know Rashard, or know of Rashard from his time in Seattle, and did this catch you off guard?
Yeah, I was definitely pretty stunned. I got a text message from our old play-by-play broadcaster while we were at lunch, and that was the first I'd heard about it. I didn't really know what to make of it. So, you know, it sounds like from what we've heard in the early reporting from the Orlando Sentinel and from what Rashard is apparently preparing as a statement that, you know, he was taking a supplement and was unaware that something that was on the banned list was in there, which I think, you know, I think is a perfectly reasonable possibility. You know, it's so easy to sit there and envision people sticking needles into their backsides is any time we hear about anyone failing a test. But, you know, there's all sorts of things out there. And it's not an excuse to the extent that you have to know. Too many players, especially in baseball, have tested positive for tainted supplements or things like that, that you, and they make it very clear to players, do not take anything that is not specifically approved that you don't know is not going to catch a positive test. But I don't think this is a case of Rashard trying to bulk up or something like that. You know, I think I'd take him at his word that it was an honest mistake.
So you're going to just completely apologize for this guy because he's a former Sonic. Is that really how this is going down right now, Kevin?
I mean, you know, there's some people out there who believe that there's this giant steroids problem in the NBA that no one is talking about, and it's that we're just pushing it all on baseball, but I've never been one of those people whatsoever. I just can't imagine it, having been in NBA locker rooms and having followed the league. I just can't envision that whatsoever. I mean, can you?
It's a tough question. One of the very first interviews I ever did for Blazers Edge was with Bobby Medina, the Blazers strength and conditioning coach. And that was like the number one question on my mind was like, okay, I'm going to confirm all these conspiracy theories about performance enhancing drugs in the NBA. And so I like asked like 10 questions, like building up to it. Like, I think I'm being so sneaky here. And I kind of like pop it in near the end of the interview, like, oh, so by the way, like how many of your players use performance enhancing drugs? Now, obviously I didn't say it that way, but I was kind of like, trying to sneak it in, and his face just goes completely blank, you know, no smile whatsoever, looks me dead in the eye, and he says, I've never seen it, I don't know anyone who's ever done it, it's not a part of the culture, guys don't want to bulk up, they want to keep their flexibility, it just doesn't work in the NBA system, you know, 82 games plus the playoffs, and frankly, I don't know enough medically about it to know if it's an issue, but doesn't it seem a little bit weird that and people think NBA athletes are the best athletes in the world, right? I mean, everyone always says, like, these NBA players could have done this Olympic sport. They could have, you know, a lot of them could play football, or some of them could have played baseball or whatever. I mean, those are, like, the pristine athletes in the entire world. And all these other sports where there's amazing athletes, like track and field, football, and baseball to a lesser extent, all have, you know, this sort of like mysterious cloud over them, and yet the NBA just gets off scot-free. I mean, it seems like we're being a little bit naive if we just think there's absolutely nothing going on. But at the same time, nobody gets caught, or hardly anyone gets caught besides Rashard Lewis. So I don't really know what to think. I mean, would you be surprised if there really was an issue and just the testing wasn't catching it? I don't think I would be. I mean, there's definitely players who I've seen just based on their physique. I'm not going to name names because that's, like, really classless. But there's some guys out there with some popcorn muscles that make you think twice. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I mean, I honestly would be surprised if there was an issue. I mean, I think that the argument about they don't want to bulk up, they want to stay skinny, is a little dubious. I mean, especially because of the fact that what was the first place we saw steroid use rampantly? Track and field. I mean, I don't think those guys are trying to, quote-unquote, bulk up. They're trying to be fast, obviously. You know, Ben Johnson is not trying to be strong. He's trying to run 100 meters as fast as he can, and apparently steroids helped in that task. But I think in baseball, you know, what we've seen from the reporting that has been done is there's sort of these clusters of people that do it because of the fact that there's the trainer, whether it's, you know, Kirk Radomski or whoever the person is that's involved with it, and they sort of get a series of people involved with it, and it's like, you know, my friend happened to tell me, hey, I can get you some of this. Would you like to try it? You know, that's kind of how the stories seem to go. And I don't know that there's that same culture in the NBA. If it does exist, it's amazingly well hidden. Because I don't think it's stunned us, the names that have come out and what we have found out about baseball. I mean, people always kind of suspected it in a way. And we always, you know, knew about guys using questionably legal supplements like androstenedione or something like that. So there's just not a comparison to me in that regard. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, I'm not even going to lie to you. I've snooped around in lockers. You know, that's how McGuire supposedly first got busted. You know, the guy found the andro in his locker. And I looked pretty carefully. I mean, not all guys are going to be that stupid, you know, because you're not allowed to take pictures in the locker room. But sometimes there's, like, funny stuff in guys' lockers. I'm not even going to lie. I'll come right out and say, yeah, I snoop in guys' lockers. And I've never seen anything more than, like, even, like, a five-hour energy or something. You know what I mean? I mean, there's just nothing. Like, the guys just don't have those supplements. And I have seen players given pain-killing medication repeatedly by the medical staff. But I've never seen anything where it's sort of like, why is that there, you know? And granted, you know, guys probably aren't going to travel on the road with it and all that. So, you know, if the guys in the Blazers aren't using it, I'm probably not really having a full picture of what's going on out there. But it's like there's not even any hints at all. So like you said, if it's a cover-up, it's like the most perfectly orchestrated cover-up ever. And you got to wonder, like, some of these guys, they get, you know, in trouble off the court for other things. And it's just like, God, they're so dumb. Like, Jamal Tindall, right? Like, that is just the dumbest situation ever. So it's like, okay, you have a guy who, like, can't keep himself out of gunfights in a parking lot. How is he going to be able to, like, orchestrate, or how is that type of person going to be able to orchestrate a steroids conspiracy? And you kind of have to wonder, like, well, he's probably not going to be able to pull that off.
I'm there, grinning and winning just like the next folded paper, thinking of ways to load another cape, and it's some cold shit to know that I could sling all night and sling all day, but never have the courage to pray, believe I know better, but somehow I feel I'm lost at the crossroad, but am I scared to move across, could it be what I'm drinking that got me thinking like I'm thinking, Lord I need help, but I can't help myself, awaken to the sound of sirens, niggas dying, kids in the street with no food to eat, prostitutes getting money in their only profession, but Lord, I've only got one question. I do G's get to go to heaven, cause I don't wanna die.
Last topic of the show today that we came up with was this whole issue of the Memphis firing their scouting department, which kind of came out in like the super sensationalistic column, I guess, not really a report, but more of a column from Jeff Calkins. Sorry if his name's not right, I'd never heard of him before this report.
You didn't hear about him when Jason Williams threw a pen in his face?
Oh, I think that, white chocolate?
I think that was Jeff Calkins. Something like that. Well, it was in the locker room and they threw a pen in him or something.
Is that the kind of thing that's going to be in the first paragraph of his obituary, assuming like they write an obituary about him, is like the man who recovered from taking a Bic to the eyeball?
If that's going to lead off his obituary, I hate to think what's going to lead off ours.
Oh, God. Well, this podcast, the guys who produced the worst Kevin or the worst Brandon and Baron podcast ever. But anyway. Okay, so back on topic here. So the report came out very sensationalistic in nature, the idea that, you know, Memphis, this team known for cutting costs, had fired their scouting department. And then he admitted, yes, okay, a couple of the guys had left, they had resigned, and then actually I think three people were fired, and it was really just their scouting department. It wasn't like they had gotten rid of all scouts entirely. And then the question got raised, you know, why do they even have five college scouts? And then the other question, if they have five college scouts, why are they drafting Sabeet, number two overall? Like, what's going on here? And it kind of turned into this, like, giant mess, and then at some point, Memphis blog had claimed that Portland didn't have any official scouts, and that was just, like, completely unnecessary and totally wrong. And then it just turned into, like, this entire, just, like, orgy of knowledge and non-knowledge. And I guess what the entire thing came down to, or the most important question out of it, is questioning the role of scouts, especially considering that, you know, we're here in 2009 where Draft Express has a database of probably 35,000 players or whatever it is who could potentially make the NBA at some point. And actually, I was reading your Draft Express profile. They say you don't go left very well, Kevin.
No, that's true. I also don't go right very well.
They said you settle for 6-foot shots on an 8-foot hoop in your driveway, and your best skill is backing down your younger brother. So, I mean, like, literally, I mean, there's so much information out there. Do NBA teams even need to have the kind of scouting they used to have? Or are we at the point where you need to have more scouts because there's so much, you know, it's an arms race and there's so much more competition? Or is there a happy medium in there somewhere? What say you?
Well, as usual, I would lean towards the happy medium. You know, I think that the interesting thing about the NBA scouting process circa 2009 is, especially again with Draft Access and NBADraft.net and Chad Ford out there on the trail, is that there's not really secrets anymore. It's not like the stories that they tell about, you know, Jerry Krause, I should say, trying to tell Scottie Pippen not to work out for other teams, that they can get him in the second round instead of taking him in the lottery when he ends up one of the greatest players of all time. It just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, there, you know, it's not that there's not guys who do better than we think or worse than we think, but if you're playing basketball anywhere in the world and you're good enough to be an NBA player, people are going to know about you. You're not turning people over under rocks anymore. So I think that to some extent, you know, what these guys that Memphis got rid of did is they're kind of the first cut. They're seeing guys in person throughout the season, and they're going back to the front office and the general manager and some of the other top people. In Portland's case, you know, I think that people are pretty familiar with that. Chad Buchanan's role as director of college scouting, and then Mike Bourne, director of pro scouting, who also gets involved with that process leading up to the draft. So these are the guys who are coming in and seeing those guys and making the final decisions, really, in concert with, you know, the GM. And you're definitely always going to have value from seeing guys in person as opposed to either watching tape, which is the other big development, is that nowadays you can get tape on basically any prospect playing college basketball or anyone playing in any of the prominent leagues in Europe, which I think has kind of helped the ability of coaches to participate in this process, because when they have time to actually think about the draft in April and May and June, none of these guys are playing other than maybe at the pre-draft camps or private workouts, but they can sit there and watch tape of them playing throughout the year. And then the other layer of it is that now you've got statistical analysis playing some role in this. Obviously, nobody paid any attention to guys' college stats other than superficially, you know, maybe 20 years ago. And I don't think there's teams that draft highly based on that, but, you know, obviously Houston is incorporating that a lot, and teams like the Blazers are certainly paying attention to college stats. So all of that, I think, has kind of changed the role of scouting, but it certainly hasn't diminished the importance of it.
Yeah, I hear you. And, you know, it seems like scouting at the end of the day, it kind of becomes a reflection of your overall organizational ethos. So in other words, if you have, like, you know, a really organized, super on top of it, really thorough management staff, then your scouting reflects that. and your drafting ends up reflecting that because you're trying to drafting for a fit. Where I think a lot of the really best teams, and they end up finding these steals in the late in the round. They draft really well because they have very specific needs that they're looking for. They're able to draft role players who fit those needs. Whereas a lot of the teams that struggle maybe aren't as organized, aren't as diligent, aren't as thorough, and they end up kind of drafting best player available in the top five, and they're kind of all over the place, and they have so many needs they're not really able to pinpoint. And I think maybe that's kind of what's happening here in Memphis, is that they seem kind of like a rudderless ship to me, all over the place, or a tipped kayak, as it were, as I went kayaking the other day and flipped over upside down. But that kind of reminds me of what's happening in Memphis, is like, they're all over the place. They're making this move for Zach Randolph. It makes no sense. They have to do it because they need to take the salary on. And they've drafted all these random parts who are all skilled in their own right, but are they going to be able to be put together into a winning team? Are they going to end up paying any of these guys, or do they even care? And at some point, if that's your organizational model and you're so unorganized and you really don't seem that motivated, does it matter if you have a few more opinions about players that you probably don't need because you've got access to the video anyways? I mean, like, shouldn't these guys have not ever existed in the first place? Shouldn't they have been fired a long time ago? That's kind of what I'm wondering, Like, why were they even there in the first place, It doesn't sound like they're listening to these guys. If they are, they shouldn't be driving to the beat. So, I don't know. It makes me, as an observer of the Blazers, that much more confident in the way they do things because of how thorough they are during the pre-draft process. We could see that, firsthand. These guys are working these players out, conducting interviews with them, getting to know them as people. That's one of their sort of buzzword phrases. And it's sort of like, does Memphis even care about any of that? I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. But maybe it's hard for me to say because I'm 2,000 miles away from their general manager staff. I'm not really sure.
I think you raised an interesting point with when you were discussing fit, and I think that might be where, especially in the modern era, the scouting staffs and front offices really distinguish themselves is teams that are able to determine which players are right for them as opposed to determining which are the best players. Because, I've been reading some stuff, some pull-ups to Moneyball. I believe it's been a little over six years now since Moneyball came out, and there was a ESPN package a couple weeks ago kind of following up with Billy Beane, and they were discussing how much now the A's and other teams kind of feel like everyone is drafting off of a similar draft board, which is not the way it used to be. And if you have that in baseball, where there are literally thousands of players getting drafted from all over the country, then you can only imagine that something similar is happening in the NBA as teams have so much more access to the same information about players, whether it be the video or, statistical analysis or anything like that. So I wonder then, if that's where you're starting to distinguish yourself, and that's why where you see the difference between a really good, late pick in late in the first round or in the second round and one that doesn't work out.
Indeed. Hey, do you think that Europe is still like uncharted waters when it comes to the whole scouting thing? Because it seems like some teams really have invested time and the personnel in finding those European prospects and other teams maybe not so much. I mean, like the Blazers, for example, they've got a guy over there full-time. The Lakers have had a guy over there full-time for a long time. I mean, there's so much more, it's so much easier access to college prospects compared to the European prospects. I wonder if some teams skimp on that European side.
As much as we were talking about how ultimately it's the director of pro scouting, the director of college scouting, the general manager who are making these decisions and coming in and seeing these guys, with the most important opinions, but it's that much tougher for them to see guys that are in Europe. They're maybe going to see them once or twice a year at the absolute best. So I think you're much more reliant on your scouts on the ground over in Europe than you are with players in the U.S. So I think that you do see a difference in the quality of scouting there. And the Oklahoma City Thunder, by the way, have two European scouts. I think that makes them fairly unique.
No kidding. Have they drafted any European? Oh, they have Serge Ibaka, right?
Yeah, sure.
Where is he actually from?
He's from the Republic of the Congo as opposed to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but he played in Spain.
So he's from the Republic of Congo. That's obviously in Europe. Then who else have they drafted from Europe?
He played in Spain. They scouted him there. They signed in Ed Kerstich, who was playing over in Spain, but I think that would be about it since Sam Presti has taken over.
No kidding. Well, that's very interesting. Well, I mean, hey, here's a quick question, and then 30 seconds or less. Is Sam Presti overrated now? Because remember when Simmons came out with that whole Paul Millsap is overrated because he's been underrated for so long? Is that what's happened to Sam Presti? I mean, has Sam Presti really done anything? And again, 30-second response. He drafted Durant, who fell in his lap, easiest pick ever. Westbrook is good, jury's still out. Green, arguably overrated. And the rest of the roster is garbage because he won't spend any money. I mean, is he really that good? Don't you think he's a little overrated?
Well, you know, I'm hesitant to comment on the situation because of how close I was to it at one point. But I will say this, that I think that there's a phenomenon that we saw with Kevin Pritchard in Portland where anytime someone starts getting too much credit for what they're doing, then it's going to inevitably lead up to having them take a fall, like some people thought that Pritchard did at the start of this summer. I'm reminded of a quote from Moneyball, which I actually happen to be rereading, so that's part of why I'm referencing. It starts out with the quote, "That which the gods wish to destroy, they first call promising." So be careful making too much of what someone does because of the fact that, you know, eventually it's going to look bad in the end. But I think he's done a phenomenal job, Sam Presti. I think that Oklahoma City is set up very well for success for the long term.
There's absolutely no chance that I say anything smarter than that quote. So we're going to end the podcast on that note.
Used to rhyme, so in that I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer. Come.